Accession number 19382, Reel 2.
What, another Reel 2?
Yes, there was another code that consisted of a mixture of figures and letters. That was more difficult to receive. And actually, there was a third code which was not particularly high security classification, but consisted generally of just two letter groups, and I think it was really a relic of the First World War mainly. You sent out, I can't remember what the exact letters were, but you sent out these letters to say that there were enemy ships a few hundred yards away on the starboard bow or something like that. Well, the idea in the Second World War of enemy ships being a few hundred yards away on the starboard bow was not likely to be a very frequent occurrence in the Second World War, but nevertheless, this was thought to be at least a possibility, so you had this code as well. But the main one were the five-figure ones, and we used to, and also a certain amount of we used to learn how to deal with those and how to receive them. And also we learned how to receive plain language messages, although there were virtually none of those in the actual war. And then there were the more general training and assimilation. The Navy were very keen, of course, as I imagine they are today, on tradition. And were keen on making things in a shore establishment as like as it possibly could be to being on a ship. They tried to reproduce, and I think it's probably quite sensible, although we were in fact on these former boarding houses along the front in Douglas, they had to be operated as if you were on a ship. So, for example, if you wanted to go, in inverted commas, ashore, which meant going into the town, you could only go ashore if you were on a ship, if a liberty boat came along and took you to shore. And consequently, in the shore establishment, you were only allowed to go into the town if an inverted commas, liberty boat arrived at a certain date, time, and you were allowed out at this particular time. It was as if you were on a ship, if you see what I mean. And this was, you know, slightly absurd, I suppose, really. But and parts of the road were cordoned off and said to be the quarter deck. And on a quarter deck, you were supposed to run across the quarter deck, and so you had to run across this particular piece of road and that type of thing. They were very keen on that. The man in charge, I think, was a former RN captain of a very fierce disposition, I recall.
Did you run foul of him?
No, I don't think I ran. The main people you came in contact with were chief petty officers and people like that who had served in the First World War, generally speaking, and were on shore establishments at that time, teaching you, and they did. I think they did a good job.
What was life like on the Isle of Man in 44?
Oh, very good. Fine, really. I mean, there was quite a lot of entertainment and dances and that sort of thing. I mean, obviously you had the blackout and so on and so forth, but no, things were good, and some of the voluntary services, I recall, were very good too. I mean, I remember particularly the Salvation Army. I've always thought very highly of them. In fact, had a covenant to pay money to them because I very much respected what they were doing. I mean, they weren't the sort of people who made a great issue of religion. And but of course, religion, I think, actually was, forgetting the Salvation Army for a moment, I think religion was rather to the fore in the war, in my experience. I mean, I know I got confirmed in the Church of England, I must say, by a Royal Naval Padre at the time. But Royal Naval Padres were an interesting lot of people. I mentioned this rather fierce captain, and I remember the we had to go to church parade every Sunday, and the Royal Naval Padre gave a sort of address at the end of the ceremony, or the end of the service, I should say. We used to not only have these boarding houses, but also the must have been formerly a local ballroom. And these services used to take place in this after we'd marched around a bit. And the address by the padre was thought to be, I think, by this captain, to be slightly lacking in militarism and general attitude towards the Germans. And he then strode to the platform and proceeded to put us right on what the right attitude towards the Germans really ought to be in terms of, the Hun and so on and so forth.
Had your parents been interested in religion?
No, not really at all. Scarcely at all, really. I mean, they were very straightforward people, but not in a religious sense.
So, what were your comrades like at Douglas?
Oh, I don't know. They were a very mixed bunch of people. I got on pretty well with them, I think. I don't remember any difficulty or any particular characteristics, really. I mean, we were all youngsters, of course, and we were learning. I don't think there was any particular patriotism, mind you. I think, if anything, I think I probably was more, I don't know, that sounds rather boasting, really, but I think I was perhaps more politically aware than some of them, really. I don't think it was much. I mean, they were just, they knew they were in the forces. They had to do what they were told. I mean, I don't remember any particular indiscipline or anything of that sort. Of course, there were occasional instances of it, and I mean, people used to get hauled up, and I remember they used to make a great issue, particularly this captain, of having everybody assembled and reading out the charges for somebody who'd been convicted of something like theft, for example. Theft was thought to be a very serious offence in the Royal Navy, because you were stealing from your comrades. And they were usually sent off to serve in the detention barracks. I'm not sure if I got this right, really, but the captain used to say, he's been convicted of this, and the normal penalty is, and then there'd be some frightful penalty that might actually be applied, but of course never was, and he was sent off for a few months in the detention barracks. But we were all assembled to see this, as a warning to us all that, you jolly well better behave yourselves. And I must say that I think fear of the detention barracks was perhaps the captain was right, because fear of the detention barracks, I think in my case at any rate, and I dare say others too, was quite a substantial deterrent to doing anything seriously wrong.
Did you know what went on in the detention barracks?
Well, you were always told about people having to run around and generally life being made absolutely miserable for them.
Did you have any difficulty with the course at Douglas?
No, none at all. No, I found it fairly easy. I came out. I suppose there were a group of about, I don't know, perhaps as many as 50 or 60 of us, or even more, in this intake. Various intakes went through the training process. And I came out top of the group anyway.
Now, after this, after Douglas?
Well, we'd all... You got some ships coming into Douglas, and naval ships, destroyers and things like that, and I'd rather hoped, I might have the opportunity to actually have a go on one of those, but I never did. And so after Douglas, we actually had a time guarding the... there was a large internment camp on Douglas as well, and we had a time guarding this with rifles and small arms and so on. Not that there was ever any problem, as far as I know, but I suppose for appearances' sake or whatever, they had to have guards around this camp, and we were involved in that for a time.
And then, presumably, you left Douglas for somewhere else?
Yes, then left Douglas, and all naval ratings in those days were allocated to one of three depots. It was either Portsmouth or Devonport or Chatham. In my case, it was Portsmouth, and so I went down to Portsmouth. Now, while I had been training, D-Day took place, and then fighting was going on in Europe, of course. And I got then to Portsmouth, and I think we had a fairly short time in barracks there. And then the Navy were very keen on getting us allocated ships. When I reflect on the situation, I'm not sure the Navy weren't rather keen on making sure they made some effort to make sure everybody was on a ship, so as to ensure they weren't taken away and put in the army or something like that, which of course was very short of infantry, and 18-year-olds would have been rather suitable for that sort of job. But anyway, we were allocated to ships, but only in a supernumerary capacity, really. And I was allocated to this trawler. It was an old French trawler. I imagine it had been taken over, being in a British port, and it was called La Nantaise, and it was probably taken over at the outbreak or when France collapsed, I suppose, and had been adapted for a naval escort duty job. And so it got quite a large gun on the front, 4-inch gun, and Oerlikon guns around the side in case of air attack, and 0.5 machine gun at the back, and lots of depth charges. And so they said, oh, go and join this ship. And I said, yes, okay. Or whatever the right order, aye, aye, sir, I suppose. And off I went. And the first thing, I had to try and find it. It wasn't easy. Anyway, I found it. It was a group of 6 trawlers, and I had to scramble over these trawlers, in fact, to get to this particular one. And there I found it, and it was fine. And I must say, I enjoyed my time on this. And we were involved in convoying, although I dare say most of the Germans were far away by then, convoying supplies across to France. And we used to go across to Cherbourg and to Le Havre from Portsmouth, escorting convoys of ships.
What about your own work in the ship?
Well, I used to, take over a part of a watch sometimes, receiving messages, and particularly doing decoding. There wasn't an enormous amount of traffic, mainly about keeping the convoy together, and, as I recall it, the weather forecast as well, which was always sent out in naval code, had to be decoded and passed on to the captain, who was an R&R, and incidentally, not a Royal Navy officer. And I suppose the crew was about 30 or 40, something like that, on this actual trawler. And we were quite busy, I must say. We used to go like a yo-yo effect, really. I mean, we were off to France one day and back the next day, and we used to go to and fro practically all the time for quite a, you know, it was all difficult almost to know which side of the channel you were on after a while.
But you implied that you preferred life aboard a Royal Navy ship to life in a shorebed.
Oh yes, very much so. Once you got used, of course, to not being seasick, and that was a substantial obstacle to get over, and you felt like death, of course, and while you were subject to being seasick. But once you got over that, life aboard ship was quite nice, really. And in fact, I mean, if it was really rough, you used to rather enjoy it, really. But I did, at any rate. I mean, being in a really heavy sea and a fairly small ship is an exhilarating experience, in my opinion. But others might differ about that. But we used to do this watch system, as I say. There were 3 radio operators already there when I got there, and they were perfectly capable of operating a 3-watch system without me being there. But I was a bit of a help, I think. We had hammock. Some were in bunks, some were in hammock. I was in a hammock, actually, which was okay. That was reasonably comfortable. Food was okay, and they did their own catering, their own food. Kip cooked their own. There was a man there who was a cook, and he did the cooking, and that was all fine. Fairly small crew. We were in the forecastle with the seamen and the engineers and stokers and so on and so forth. were in the stern of the ship, and the officers were in the midships, which was a bit more comfortable. It was a coal burning ship, incidentally, so every so often you used to have to go off to the docks and get filled up with coal. It was quite unusual. I mean, most were oil burning, of course, by then.
And no contact with the enemy?
Well, only on one scare, really. I don't think there was much in that, really. I think we dropped a few depth charges, but I don't really think there was a worry about German contact with German submarines, but I doubt very much whether there was anything in that.
Any contact at that time with the French?
None at all. No. And in fact, I mean, our captain wouldn't even allow us to go ashore in France. So there was virtually no contact.
What happened after La Nantaise?
Well, after that, we came back to... I think the Exmoor came after that, didn't
yes.
it? That's right. The object of the Exmoor expedition has never been clear to me. But we were sent out to the Mediterranean in this Exmoor, probably to engage in a war against Japan, I should think. And I imagine, incidentally, that's why the Royal Navy were keen on holding on to their men, which in that sense was quite a sensible strategy, because the war in the Pacific was thought to be predominantly a naval war. The Exmoor was a very small destroyer, but it actually was the commander on it of a destroyer flotilla. And we went out to the Mediterranean in most delightful weather and beautiful seas and so on, and worked up the ship and the flotilla in practicing with the guns and that sort of thing. And I think also, and then I think there was some question, although I was never very clear about this, I think there was some question that we might have gone off to Israel to stop Israeli people going into Israel, actually. But I think we were recalled, at any rate, while we were in the middle of the Mediterranean.
Any experiences you had in the Med?
Well, not really. I mean, we obviously were based in Malta, which is quite a nice place to be. So that was quite in, call it Gibraltar, and it was a very pleasant time, really.
How did you like being in the Exmoor as compared with La Nantaise?
Well, Exmoor was a good deal larger, but even so, it was tremendously cramped. I don't know. I think if anything, La Nantaise was rather more fun, if anything. But Exmoor was perfectly okay, and a very small ship.
And after this?
Well, after that, I think we came back to Britain, and then were sent out to Australia. Could you turn it off for a moment? So I think the sequence of events was that we were recalled from the Mediterranean because the war against Japan had come to a much speedier end than anybody had expected, and then were sent out to Australia for reasons which are quite obscure to me, and were based in Australia in a shore base called the Golden Hind.
What was the voyage in HMS London like?
That was fine. It was more like a peacetime journey, except that it was quite crowded and, of course, desperately hot. It was fine. I did actually serve as a ship's company in the London, so that you weren't just a passenger, if you see what I mean. You actually were involved in the operation of the ship and doing the radio services and so on. So that was okay.
This presumably was a cruiser.
Yes, a cruiser. Yeah. Yes. Like the Belfast, I suppose, and these cruisers. Quite, I mean, very much bigger ship than anything I'd been used to before, and really was rather different. I mean, in the sense that on the London, you had rather higher ranking people, for example, in charge of the radio office and so on. But and And, I mean, by that time, with the war over, you could actually send messages in plain language as well. And I remember that people who'd been so used to receiving these five-figure codes for year upon year upon year found receiving plain language messages extremely difficult. But that went off all right in the end.
So you were just about to tell me about Sydney, I think.
Well, Sydney, yes. I mean, Sydney was very nice because the Australians welcomed us very much and looked after us very, very, very well in Sydney itself. And there were nice clubs and so on and so forth that you could go to, and everybody was very, very welcoming. We had arrived first in Western Australia and then went round to Sydney. It was in the summertime. It was quite a nice time of year to be there.
Did you have any actual work to do at HMS Golden Hind?
No, Golden Hind, no, nothing to do there.
So you were just waiting for instructions?
That's right, yes. And then the instructions came along to join this Australian destroyer, actually, a ship called the Quiberon, or Quiberon, HMAS ship, that was going up to Japan, and there were only a few British people on it. It was almost entirely an Australian crew. Got on right with them, fine really. But they were going to because there was a large Australian contingent in the occupation forces in Japan. And I suppose they wanted an Australian contingent in the naval force. And there was a large naval force in Japanese waters at the time as well. But the journey from Sydney to Japan is an extremely long one, thousands of miles. And although we called in at one or two places, like New Britain, on the way, mainly it was going through the Pacific, and you know, just a very, very long journey indeed. It took, I don't know how long, but it took some weeks to get there, as I recall it.
Did the Australian Navy have any different way of going on from the Royal Navy?
Well, they were more free and easy, and also, I must say, they were rather better equipped than the Royal Navy were. I mean, the Royal Navy were not too hot on having things like refrigerators on ships, whereas the Australians, who probably were rather more used to hot climates and that sort of thing, used to look after themselves rather better than the Royal Navy did. But no, in general, I mean, things were much the same.
What was the attitude towards Britishers?
That was okay. I didn't come across any problems. I mean, I think it reflected the general attitude of the civilian population too, who were very pleased to see us there. Although the war ended, and obviously the threat from the Japanese, which would have made them even keener to see us there, was no longer present. They were fine, and we got on very well. I certainly don't remember any problems.
And you seem to have arrived in Japan about April.
Well, that's right. As I recall it, when we arrived in Japan, after having gone right through the Pacific and the equator and so on and so forth, and the weather was extremely hot, of course, we arrived in Japan in the inland sea in a rather bitterly cold day. I don't think anybody was really expecting that. It was a damp, foggy, very cold day, and we went through the inland sea, which in better weather we were to discover is a quite delightful area of Japan, and arrived and passed these ships with Japanese ships with their upper works and so on and so forth, showing as we went through they'd been sunk by bombing. And arrived at Kirei in southern Japan, which actually was the Japanese naval base in southern Japan, or had been.
What impression did you get of Kirei?
Well, it was a scene of devastation. Oddly, for some reason or another, not really so well cleared up as we were subsequently to find in Hiroshima. I don't know why that would be. Initially, we were based on a ship called the Glenearn, G-L-E-N-E-A-R-N. It was a depot ship that had arrived there rather earlier. And we were based on that ship until the until a naval base had been constructed ashore, which was in the process of being constructed. And so we were on the Glen Erne for, I suppose, about a month, probably. But almost immediately, we had to take up duties of watchkeeping and radio traffic and so on and so forth. So we were busy almost straight away, really. The Glen Erne was quite a comfortable ship. It was quite a big ship, actually, and that was okay.
Was it explained to you what you were supposed to be doing there?
No, that was the perhaps odd thing about it, although when one reads subsequent accounts, it seems to me that almost nobody in the forces is given any clue as to what they're doing anyhow, and certainly that would be consistent with us. In a sense, it wasn't quite such an oddity for us because we had got a clear job to do at any rate. We had got the job to do of maintaining this radio station and sending and receiving messages. And there was a moderate amount of traffic too, because as I said earlier, there were quite a few ships in Japanese waters. I think the Belfast was there for one. And quite a lot of destroyers. Why they were there, I don't know, except they subsequently proved quite useful when the Korean War started. But so we had a clear job to do at any rate. So in a sense, it led to us rather less questioning about the purpose of the operation. And I don't think anybody was ever clear, and I don't think they've ever been clear afterwards as to exactly why we were in Japan. I mean, it was thought to be the normal thing, of course, after all. I mean, Germany had occupation forces, and so it seemed rather logical, I suppose, that there should be some in Japan. But I don't think, from what I heard, the Americans, I don't think, were desperately keen on the British taking over part of Japan. And then it was always said, I'm not sure how truthful this was, that the bit they gave us to take over included the areas where atomic bombs had dropped.
What was the official title of the force to which you were attached?
It was called the British Commonwealth Occupation Force. And the British were there in fairly large numbers. I think the Australians were the major party. And there was a large Indian contingent as well. We didn't see very much of the of the other national groups, really. I mean, it was mainly, we mainly met the other naval people. Then, as I say, after a month, we went ashore to the shore establishment, which was the usual thing in Nissen huts and so on and so forth. The roads were covered in mud, but it was okay. And we were there for about another 4 or 5 months. That was reasonably comfortable. We were quite well looked after. In fact, we were looked after hand and foot by Japanese people. Did the laundry, the cooking, and so on and so forth. So we didn't have to do much in that direction. But as I say, we did actually have a job to do there, and we're doing it.
How did these Japanese help us perform?
Oh, pretty well, I think. Yes, I think that I don't remember any difficulty. They were always very, very polite, of course, as the Japanese are. And I think they were, generally speaking, very pleasant.